Thank you very much for the possibility of talking to you about our institute.
Ich habe eben im Plenum ja einige ganz wenige Sätze über die Zielsetzung des Institutes gesagt.
I've said one or two things about the goals of our institute in the plenary session just now.
Und ich möchte das etwas weiter ausführen heute Morgen.
And I want to develop that a little bit.
Zunächst zu mir persönlich.
First of all, let me tell you a little bit about myself.
Ich komme nicht aus einem christlichen Elternhaus.
I don't come from a Christian background.
Wenn ich in der Schule im Gymnasium war, konnte ich mich entscheiden in dem sprachlichen und mathematischen Zweig.
In school I decided to study the humanities and mathematical side of things.
Und die gleiche Entscheidung wie ich hat nur noch ein anderer Junge aus unserer Klasse getroffen.
And one other person in my class made the same decision as I did to do the same subjects.
Und dieser Junge war ein Christ.
And this young man was a Christian. And he spoke to me about the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. And for me, it was something totally new. And so I started to read the New Testament. The other people in the class had an explanation for this other young man who had spoken to me.
Seine Eltern sind Christen, also ist er auch Christ.
His parents are Christian, so he's a Christian.
Aber ich dachte, die Frage, ob Jesus von den Toten auferstanden ist, hat eigentlich nichts mit seinen oder meinen Eltern zu tun.
But it appeared to me that the question whether Jesus had risen from the dead or not had nothing to do either with his parents or mine.
Und so versuchte ich das für mich selber herauszufinden, was daran wahr ist.
And so I tried to find out for myself what was the truth of the matter. So I studied ancient history and Egyptology
in
Munich.
Ich wurde Christ während meines Studiums.
I became a Christian during my time as a student.
Und war dann lange Jahre bei der IFES in Deutschland angestellt.
And then worked for many years with IFES in Germany. Jürgen, actually, if I might add, was a general secretary of the German movement, the Studentenmission Deutschlands.
Ich habe von Anfang an Vorträge an Universitäten gehalten.
And from the very beginning I held lectures in different universities
über die Auferstehung Jesu, was ein Historiker dazu sagen kann.
As a historian speaking on the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Über Glaube und Skepsis.
Speaking about faith and skepticism.
Und dann auch über das Thema Leid.
And then speaking about the topic of suffering.
Was in besonderer Weise auch mit meinem Leben verbunden ist.
Because that was a topic that's very close to my heart from my own experience.
Ich bin in den 70er Jahren regelmäßig mit DDR gefahren.
In the 70s I used to travel regularly into the German Democratic Republic.
Und habe dort gesprochen, was für mich nicht erlaubt war.
And I gave lectures there what wasn't exactly permitted.
Man konnte, das waren auch keine Vorträge, sondern Grußworte.
They weren't official lectures, they were greetings that I used to bring to the people there. And they lasted 45 minutes. And if anybody had a question, I tried to compress it and answer it in about 45 minutes. But one time I was coming back from the German Democratic Republic and we had a terrible motor accident.
Und meine Familie, meine Frau und unser Kind kam dabei ums Leben.
And my wife and our child were both killed.
Ich habe als Einziger diesen Unfall überlebt.
And I was the only one to survive the accident.
So das ist auch ein Teil meiner Geschichte, auch für die Vorträge, die ich halte.
So this is a part of my history that's very relevant to the kind of lecture I give on suffering and pain.
Im Jahre 99 haben wir dann das Institut gegründet für Glaube und Wissenschaft.
In 1999 we started this institute for faith and science.
Und hatten zwei Zielsetzungen.
And we had two goals for the institute.
Einmal, dass wir den Dialog zwischen Wissenschaft und christlichem Glauben fördern wollten.
Firstly, we wanted to promote a real discussion among Christians about the faith.
Und Wissenschaftlern, die keine Christen sind.
And also with scientists who were not Christians.
Und wollten eine Orientierung geben in der pluralistischen Gesellschaft.
And we wanted to give people some kind of orientation in a pluralistic society.
Und wir machen das auf dreierlei Weise.
And we have three basic ways in which we do this.
Erstens die Publikationen im Internet.
First of all, our publications in the Internet.
Das ist eine ganz enorme Möglichkeit, gerade auch Nicht-Christen zu erreichen.
This is a tremendous opportunity to reach non-Christians.
Etwa 15 Professoren verschiedener Fachrichtungen unterstützen mich bei dieser Arbeit.
There are around 15 professors from different subjects, different subject directions who support me in this work.
So haben wir Texte drin zum Thema, ist der Kosmos für den Menschen geschaffen?
For example, we have a text in the Internet which is entitled, Was the Cosmos Created for Human Beings?
Oder Neurotheologie, ist Gott im Hirn?
Or Neurotheology, is God in the brain?
Oder Evolution, was sind Fakten, was ist Spekulation?
Evolution, what are the facts, what is speculation?
Was glaubt der Homo economicus?
What does the Homo economicus, economical man, believe?
Und wir haben im Moment etwa 7.000 bis 8.000 Downloads in einem Monat.
And we get nowadays 7.000 to 8.000 downloads every month.
Und das ist eine sehr hohe Zahl für Deutschland. Which, sind auf Deutsch.
Which is a very high number for Germany. All the texts are in fact in German.
Einige wenige Texte sind auf Russisch.
But some few texts are in Russian.
Wir haben einige Texte veröffentlicht in dem Journal der Akademie der Wissenschaften Russland.
We've in fact been able to publish some texts in the newspaper Poisk, which is the newspaper for the Academy of Sciences in Russia.
Und wir machen auch jeden Monat eine Liste der Top 10.
And every month we make a list of the top 10, that is in terms of quantity of downloads.
Und das ist sicher auch anregend für jemanden, der das sieht.
And of course that's quite encouraging and interesting for people who see it.
Und denken, das sind die zehn beliebtesten Texte, die will ich mir auch ansehen.
And they say, ah, those are the 10 most interesting texts, I want to read them as well.
Am meisten werden die Texte abgefragt, die sich mit dem Thema Naturwissenschaft und Glaube beschäftigen.
Mostly people are interested in the texts that deal with the science-faith interface.
Und jeden Monat kommen neue Texte dazu.
And every month we add new texts to the collection.
So dass es sich für einen Leser lohnt, alle paar Wochen nachzusehen, gibt es was Neues.
So it's worthwhile for any reader to look into the internet every couple of weeks to see if there's something new.
Einige Schulen, an denen Christen unterrichten, haben die Internetseite des Instituts auf der Homepage ihrer Schule.
Some schools where their Christian teachers teaching have put the homepage of our institute on the homepage of their school so that it's accessible.
Und es gibt manchmal Post von Lehrern, die mir sagen, dass ihre nicht-christlichen Kollegen sehr positiv reagieren auf diese Internetseite.
And he sometimes gets letters from Christian teachers to tell him that their non-Christian colleagues find the text extremely interesting.
So wir machen den Text für den Endverbraucher.
So we produce the text for the end user.
Schüler, Studenten, Lehrer, Pfarrer und alle, die an der Diskussion um Glauben und Wissenschaft interessiert sind.
So school children, teachers, pastors, ministers and so on. Anybody who's interested in this discussion about faith and science.
Das zweite sind, publizieren wir eine Paperback-Reihe.
The second level of our activity is the paperback series that we have founded.
Wir haben gestartet mit einem Buch von John zum Thema, hat die Wissenschaft Gott begraben?
They started with my book on Has Science Buried God?
In dem ersten Jahr hatten wir drei Auflagen.
We had three printings in the first year.
Und in diesem Jahr werden wir ziemlich sicher eine vierte Auflage haben.
And he's pretty sure, I don't know, that we're going to have a fourth one this year.
Another book
that was published is over genetic technology, genetic engineering.
Ein anderes über Dostoevsky.
Another one about Dostoevsky.
Und eins von einem Physiker über das Verhältnis von Glaube und Wissenschaft.
And a book by a physicist, which is Peter Hegele from Ulm, which is about faith and science.
Das nächste wird über Globalisierung sein, geschrieben von einem Professor für Wirtschaftswissenschaft.
The next book is going to be about globalization, written by an economist.
Das nächste, was wir machen, wir bieten Tagungen an.
And then the next level of activities is we offer conferences.
Eine Tagung im Jahr über Literatur.
We have one every year about literature.
Dostoevsky,
C.S. Lewis, Chesterton, for example.
Andere Tagungen über allgemeine interessierende Themen.
And other conferences about topics of general interest.
Dieses Jahr wird es sein, die Frage, wie frei ist der Mensch?
This year we're having a conference on the topic, how free is the human being?
In einer Diskussion mit der Hirnforschung.
And the discussion with people who are doing brain research.
Wir hatten auch schon mal eine Tagung für Juristen.
We've already had a conference for the legal experts, for the law people.
Über die Frage, inwieweit ist das islamische Recht kompatibel mit dem europäischen Recht?
And the discussion was, in how far is Islamic law compatible with European law?
Wir gehen von 30 Teilnehmern aus.
We reckon with about 30 participants at each of these conferences.
Aber bei den Literaturtagungen kommen die letzten Mal auch eher 60 oder mehr als 60.
But in fact, for the last literature conference, we got around 60.
Und dann wollen wir demnächst starten mit einer kleinen informellen Gruppe von Leuten, die an Apologetik interessiert sind.
And we want to have a small conference soon for people who are interested in doing apologetics.
Was sind die Fragen und wie können wir darauf antworten?
What are the main questions? How can we, in Germany that is, how can we answer the questions that people are asking?
Und darüber hinaus gebe ich weiterhin Vorträge.
And beyond that, I constantly give lectures.
Zu den Vorträgen, wo am meisten Nichtchristen kommen, gehören die Vorträge über Dostojewski, auch in Deutschland.
And even in Germany, the lectures which are attended by most non-Christians are the lectures I give about Dostoevsky.
Im Dezember war ich an der Universität Heidelberg.
I was giving a lecture at Heidelberg University in December.
Und es waren dort so viele Studenten in dem Raum, dass ich über die Studenten steigen musste, um zu meinem Pult zu kommen.
And there were so many students in the room that he had to walk over them in order to get to the lecture theater. That's like C.S. Lewis, you know, he used to do that.
Und als ich am Pult stand, konnte ich mich nicht mehr bewegen, weil um mich herum auch Studenten saßen.
And it was very difficult to speak because there were students all around me standing at the lectern.
Ich konnte nicht fliehen.
I couldn't escape either.
Die Tür war auf.
The door was open.
Und die Studenten standen in Dreierreihen in den Flur.
And there was a three deep crowd of students in the corridor outside the door.
Es war ein sehr großer Hörsaal. Es war nicht so.
It's a very big lecture room, not something like this.
Und die meisten waren keine Christen.
Most of them unbelievers.
Eine sehr interessierte Diskussion anschließend.
And there was a very interesting discussion at the end of the talk.
Ich habe auch in Russland schon viele Vorlesungen über Dostoevsky gehalten.
I've also given many lectures on Dostoevsky in Russia.
Und hatte das für eine ganz große Möglichkeit, dort ins Gespräch auch mit Professoren zu kommen.
And I count it as a real opportunity to get into conversation not only with students, but with professors as well.
Ich möchte eine, wie ich finde, sehr lustige Geschichte erzählen.
I want to tell you a funny story.
Als ich einmal in Akademgorodok bei Novosibirsk über
I was once in Academic City, Akademgorodok near Novosibirsk.
Ich sprach über Dostoevsky und das Neue Testament.
I give a lecture about Dostoevsky and the New Testament.
Und der dortige Professor für Deutsch hat mich übersetzt.
And the professor of German there translated me.
Er kam aus North Korea.
He came from North Korea.
Und als die Vorlesung begann, sagte er, es ist das erste Mal, dass ich in meinem Leben ein neues Testament in der Hand habe.
And at the very start of the lecture, he said, this is the first time in my life I've ever held a New Testament in my hand.
Und ich fand das eine ganz paradoxe Situation.
And I found that such a paradoxical situation.
Dass ein Deutscher im Wald von Sibirien einen Vortrag über einen russischen Autor hält.
That a German is holding a lecture in a wood in Siberia about a Russian author.
Und ein Nordkoreaner übersetzt ihn vom Deutschen ins Russische.
And a North Korean translates him from German to Russian.
Das andere habe ich auch schon erklärt mit dem Professorenpodium.
Another thing, and I said something about this already, is the Professorenpodium, the professor discussion.
Dass einige Professoren, wir waren zu sechs, jeder 3 Minuten erzählt, warum er Christ ist, und 3 Minuten erzählt, was sein Christsein mit seinem Fach zu tun hat.
This is a forum in a large auditorium where you have half a dozen professors, and at the beginning, each of them has 3 minutes to explain their relationship to the Christian faith.
Das Interessante war nicht nur, dass über 300 Studenten kamen, sondern dass unter diesen Hörern auch viele Professoren waren.
And what was very interesting was not only that over 300 students came, but that in the audience there was a considerable number of professors.
Und auch bei der zweiten Veranstaltung kamen über 200 Studenten.
And the second time we did this, we had over 200 students.
Und am nächsten Montag haben wir unser nächstes Treffen zu überlegen, was wir als nächstes tun können.
And on this coming Monday, we are going to sit together and discuss what we're going to do in the next one.
Und es ist auch gut zu hören, dass an anderen Universitäten in Deutschland so etwas auch stattfinden soll.
And it's really good to hear that this idea is catching on, and this kind of thing will be done at other universities in Germany.
Als wir das Institut gegründet haben, war unsere Zielsetzung auch, die säkulare Welt zu erreichen.
When we started our institute, we had a very clear goal of reaching secular society.
Das ist nicht einfach.
That's not easy.
Ich denke, dass wir das teilweise können über Internet.
And I think that we can do that partly through the Internet involvement.
Ich bekomme oft Post von Nichtchristen, die sich über die Artikel äußern.
I often get letters from unbelievers who are making comments on the articles.
Wobei die Leute sehr positiv auf die Texte reagieren.
And the reaction is largely positive.
Einer fragt mich, die Texte wären sehr gut, das Einzige, was ihn stört, ist, dass es so christlich ist.
One wrote and said, the texts are very good, the only thing that really disturbs me is they're so Christian.
Er hatte als Einstieg Text über Physik.
And that came from a text in physics.
Interessanterweise haben wir einen gewissen Einfluss oder nicht Einfluss, Reaktionen über die Presse.
We've had some reactions, interestingly, from the press.
Das hängt an dem Namen Institut für Glaube und Wissenschaft.
And that has to do with our name, the Institute for Faith and Science or Knowledge.
Die deutsche Sektion, kann man sagen, also the American Scientific, Spektrum der Wissenschaft.
Yeah, the Scientific American.
Sie haben mich gefragt, dass Sie einen Autor suchen zu dem Thema Neurotheologie.
They came to him and asked him, did he know an author who could write on neurotheology? Neurotheology.
Das ist die Frage, wo Gott im Hirn sitzt.
Yes, where is God in the brain?
Und das ist keine Ausnahme. Es kommt ab und zu vor, dass weltliche oder auch christliche Zeitschriften sich bei uns erkundigen für einen Autor zu einer bestimmten Materie.
Now that's not an exception. It's happening regularly that purely secular organizations come to him to ask for advice, where can I find this or that or this author or that author.
Ich versuche dann natürlich Christen zu vermitteln, die auch etwas substanziell Christliches zu der Thematik schreiben können.
And of course I try to put them in touch with Christians who have got something substantive to say on the topic under consideration.
Was gesucht wird, ist ein Christ, wenn es geht, der Professor ist und der sehr schnell schreiben kann.
Yeah, what is necessary is a Christian who's a professor and who can write fast.
Was mich sehr gefreut hat, dass es vor einiger Zeit eine Sendung im Fernsehen gab über Gentechnik.
What was really pleasing to me was to see a TV broadcast recently on genetic engineering.
Und am Ende haben sie 2 Bücher empfohlen.
And at the end of the TV program, they recommended 2 books.
Eines davon war unser Buch.
One was our book.
Und sie sagten, das ist ein gutes Buch, wenn es auch von Christen ist.
And they said, this is a good book, even if it's written by Christians.
Und sie haben das gezeigt, dieses Buch.
And they showed the book.
Und das ist natürlich sehr erfreulich, in der Hoffnung, dass auch andere das gesehen haben und vielleicht daraufhin auch so ein Buch kaufen und lesen.
And of course that's very encouraging, because it means that people are likely to go out and buy the book.
Und das Letzte, was wir noch machen, wir arbeiten seitens des Instituts mit bei dem Deutschen Trinity Forum.
We also, as a last point, we work together with the German version of the Trinity Forum.
Der Trinity Forum in den USA und auch in Europa versucht ja mit Texten Nicht-Christen, die in einer Management-Position sind oder höheren Position, mit dem Evangelium zu erreichen.
The Trinity Forum, the basic idea started actually by Os Guinness. The basic idea is to use a collection of texts in order, through discussion of the text, to reach people who are in top management positions in America and in Europe.
Und wir wurden gefragt, ob wir eine deutsche Bearbeitung machen können oder ob man auch in Deutschland einsetzen kann.
And we were approached to see if we were interested in producing some material in order to get this going in the German-speaking world.
Und wir haben das gemacht und die ersten Veranstaltungen auf Deutsch haben auch stattgefunden.
And we done that, and there have been now two German-speaking Trinity Fora.
Wir halten das auch für einen ganz wichtigen Punkt, dabei stark zu helfen, weil hier auch Leute erreicht werden, die normalerweise nicht so einfach mit dem Evangelium erreicht werden können.
And we took the view that it was important for us to be involved right at the very beginning, because through this means people are reached that normally are never reached.
Ja, das ist so ungefähr das, was das Institut macht.
So that's just about what we do.
Wenn Sie Fragen haben, würde ich Sie gerne beantworten.
So now is the time for questions. In the German language, the word Wissenschaft, which I've been translating as science, means actually, it's much broader, it means essentially knowledge. Naturwissenschaft is science, so in fact it covers both the humanities and what we call the natural sciences.
So wir haben praktisch Professoren und auch dann Texte aus allen Bereichen, die an der Universität gelehrt werden.
And so anything that's taught in the universities is represented in the collection of texts we would have and the professors with whom we are involved.
Das ist nicht nur Naturwissenschaft.
Not just natural science.
Wenn auch interessanterweise diese Texte am meisten abgefragt werden.
Even though it's the natural science texts that are of apparent most interest to people.
Aber manchmal, wenn ich durch Deutschland fahre und an Universitäten spreche, kommen Studenten zu mir.
But sometimes when I go around Germany and give lectures and students come up to me.
Medizinstudenten oder Studenten für Sozialpädagogik.
For example, medical students or students of the social sciences.
Und wir sind sehr dankbar für die Texte, die sich mit Bioethik beschäftigen.
And they're very grateful to me and say so for the texts on bioethics that we have in our internet collection.
So auch wenn wir damit nicht vielleicht so viele erreichen wie bei den anderen, glaube ich, dass wir da auch einen ganz guten Dienst machen.
So even though we may not be reaching so many people with the humanities text, still he's very grateful that there's clearly a group out there who's getting some real value from them.
So am I understanding correctly that there is someone more interested in the science material than in the humanities material?
Ja, aber.
Yes, but.
Es ist so, dass ich vermute, in Deutschland sind, wenn die meisten Christen, die Professoren sind, kommen eher aus dem Gebiet der Naturwissenschaft.
But it's true in Germany that most Christians, your professors, are natural scientists.
Und deshalb muss man kämpfen um die anderen.
And so you have to fight for the others.
Deshalb ist es wichtig, dass wir uns um Leute kümmern, die Humanities studieren.
So it's very important for us to be really concerned for people who are humanities students.
Und da gibt es ganz wenig Texte.
And there are relatively few texts in this direction that are suitable.
So dass man schon sagen kann, dass wir da eine Marktlücke füllen.
So we're really filling a hole in the marketplace by putting our texts in.
It's too bad that Dr.
He does. Oh yes, there are.
Ja, wir haben jetzt ein Buch, das habe ich aber nicht geschrieben, nur ein sicher sehr sinnvolles Vorwort zu dem Buch. Also sie haben ein Buch herausgegeben jetzt über Leben und Werk von Dostojewski aus christlicher Sicht.
Yeah. He hasn't exactly written the book in their series on Dostoevsky, but he has written what is very certainly a very sensible and intelligent foreword to it.
Es gibt zwei Artikel von mir über Dostoevsky im Internet.
And he's got two articles in the Internet. I'll just say something here, Jürgen. Jürgen has written a series of short books which are based on his lectures. He's written one called Jesus für Skeptiker, Jesus für Skeptics, and I can say that often some of the attendances at the Jesus for Skeptics conferences have been enormous, even 1,000 students at a time coming. So that's been formulated in a book. Then he's got a collection of very good quotations from C.S. Lewis in a book called Nach der Wahrheit fragen, Asking About the Truth. And then another little book called Alles ist relativ, Everything is Relative. Und noch eine, ja?
Aus gutem Grund.
Yeah, and another one, which is called Aus gutem Grund, on a good foundation or on a good basis. So there are these books, and one of the great advantages of them is they're short, they're very pithily written, there are no superfluous words, and they really, people find them very useful. So there are books in existence by Jürgen, but they're all in German, I think, aren't they, still?
They are in Serbo-Croatisch.
Ah ja, natürlich. Ja. The Serbo-Croatian, Russian.
Russian. Das Neueste ist in Polish.
Ja, yeah, sehr gut. So, also he's got one in Polish.
Katholischen Verlag.
And a Catholic publisher.
Der Papst es auch lesen kann.
So, yeah, he got it published by a Catholic publisher so that the Pope could read it. In Polish. Hungarian, you have one. You sure it's not in Hungarian? Yes, Adam.
My comment, actually, it's not only my view, but generally, probably I also read somewhere that generally probably it is much easier to meet a Christian, let's say, natural scientist. That human scientists or social societies.
Much easier.
Much easier. It is my impression at least that let's say at least from the evangelical point of view, for evangelicals, it is in my opinion, maybe it is a good question why it is so. I mean, this is what was also spoken by Jürgen, but I believe that maybe the people who are doing science, maybe they do not express their, because some of those arguments, humanistic arguments, I mean, in human science, are coming just from atheist papers on science, on natural science, and they think maybe there's no ground for some defense of Christian belief. I mean, the evangelical. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe we do not really do enough. But what is interesting also, from what he says, that these natural science papers are looked most. Mm-hmm. Because this means that maybe there is a lack. So, otherwise, for us it's not a problem to believe in evangelical God. You know, I mean, in a sense other than Catholic, because in Catholic, you could be Catholic without thinking, just because if your father were Catholic, mm-hmm. you're Catholic because this tradition. But to be evangelical, a Christian, you should believe in Bible. And I believe that maybe we sometimes we are too quiet to say the Bible is not somehow, and Bible, or let's say the faith and science are not contradicting. From the side of view of natural science, then it helps maybe the humanist to ask important questions also in there, because I mean this is very interesting what you say about that there's not many on this ground.
Do you want to comment on that?
Would you comment?
Ja, ich glaube, dass in für Geisteswissenschaftler der Umgang mit Texten sehr kompliziert dargestellt wird.
I believe that for humanities people, that often they think that getting involved with text is very complicated. They are presented with all kinds of different ways of handling text.
Ich glaube, dass hier auch ideologische Vorentscheidungen eine größere Rolle spielen als vielleicht in der Physik.
And I think that it's just here that philosophical prejudice plays perhaps a larger role than it does in the more natural sciences.
Also das ist auch eine Erfahrung, die ich mein ganzes Studentenleben gemacht habe als Christ.
And my experience as a student and a Christian right through my student life was
als ich Christ wurde als Student, wollte ich gerne die anderen Studenten treffen, die Christen sind und Historiker.
I wanted, as a Christian and a student, I wanted to meet other students who were Christians and historians like myself.
Weil ich dachte, Geschichte ist ein ganz normales Fach, müssen andere Christen auch studieren.
Because I thought, you know, history is a normal subject, there must be other Christians studying it.
Aber ich fand so gut wie keinen.
And I essentially found nobody.
Also es gibt auch wenig Christen, die da studieren. Das ist auch
I mean, so. There are, in any case, relatively few Christians studying, but nevertheless.
Jedenfalls in Deutschland.
In Germany.
If we do probably have less enculturation, at least up to biology, we have, as students, we have less enculturation in atheism and atheistic worldview. In other words, science is focused somewhere differently. And except for biology, we aren't required to submit to a worldview as firmly as perhaps other fields are.
And possibly, if I may say something, in the West, we're taught far less philosophy of science. There's much, much less of a philosophical background in education, generally speaking, in the West, in England and America and so on, compared with the kind of philosophical background you would get in France or Germany or Russia or anywhere else. A beautiful theory slain by an ugly fact. The internet address is iguw.de with www. I believe we could. There's some electronic devices fallen from the sky here.
I wonder if you could answer one other question. You obviously, in some way, have identified or adopted very effective apologetic methods. Did you say anything about the reasons why why you think so many students are interested? What is it that you do that makes it so successful, other than the Lord and the Holy Spirit? Not as simple as that. You're also doing things that can be described that would be helpful for us.
It was not that I planned these things. It was I was asked to give lectures. That was the starting point, and I did this. If you work together with students, and I come from student work, I stayed my whole life in the student work of IFES Germany. You always find in different groups very creative students with creative ideas. One example is when in 82 I gave a lecture in the University of Münster about the resurrection, and more than 200 students came. It was a really overcrowded room, and after this lecture, a friend of mine who was sitting there and and saw the discussion, he came to me afterwards and said to me, it's the one thing to give one good lecture and to answer discussions, everything okay. But if you really want that students become Christians, that is not enough. You cannot only give one lecture and maybe come 2 years again and give another lecture. So you must have 4 evenings. And at first I thought that is what I know is after 2 evenings I'm coming to an end. Let's start with 2 evenings. And then we had the next step was in Heidelberg to have 2 evenings. And then the second evening really made a difference. When I go to a city and have one lecture, I see all the people for the first time. I don't know what they think, and I will never hear of them. But if I go to the second evening, I look into faces from people with whom I have discussed last night. So I know what they really think from the discussion. And that is a total other attitude for my second lecture. And then I agreed, and then we had for the first time, we tried to have 4 evenings. It was in Münster, in this university in Münster. First we start with rice. You see 1 evening, 2, and then 3. Then was 3 in Münster, and we did it with these 3 questions from Kant. The situation was overwhelming. The group, the German group in Münster, had the problem that they only could have the biggest auditorium with 500 places. And that was really not positive. Well, they thought 30 people and 500 places, that is not good for the atmosphere. But from the beginning on, all the places were filled, from the first evening on. So that was a special situation then. And this encouraged us to go further. Then I went to Britain. And was part of an Oxford mission for some days and saw what they had done and discussed it with students in Germany, other things what we can do in Germany, or is that not our thing? And so we tried more and more things. So it's developed. And when I, in the plenary at 9 o'clock and here first said a few words about my life, then this form of apologetic has much to do with my own life, my own biography. For nearly all of the themes about which I'm speaking have a connection to my life. Skepticism and belief, I was really a skeptic. When I thought, my father always said when there was a politician speaking in TV, everything is a lie. Or when my mother said, was a neighbor had said, everything is a lie. So I'm really a skeptic person. Second, about the historicity, I'm an ancient historian and I can speak about that. The third, suffering, I had an experience. And the fourth, Dostoevsky, and I don't speak about Dostoevsky as a man who has problems, read Dostoevsky and tried to make the best out of it, but I really like Dostoevsky and have read a lot, or Camus or others, and so these things have to do with my biography. And then when I started with these things, a very interesting thing happened in the SND. Even if I was the chief of that troop, I didn't realize that the other traveling secretaries started to do the same at universities. So that was a very interesting point for me.
You mean
the
lecture about
Dostoevsky? Not about Dostoevsky, about their themes.
About their own themes.
About their own hope.
Okay, so that's a principle that you would share with us.
But you must have a connection of your themes and the themes of the group. So when I go for a week to a group, for 1 week, I have a weekend with this group. And then I ask the group, why do you wish these themes which you have proposed? What is your interest in the themes? And all the people have to tell me what is the interest of the group in the themes. Well, I say it is not enough to say we are not interested at all in the themes, but we think for our non-Christian friends. That is very helpful to hear this. Then I say maybe no non-Christian friend is coming. Then I speak to an auditorium who has definitely no interest in the subject. That is not good. I want that the Christians say we are interested and we invite to these very interesting things our friends. And so they can identify with the themes. It's not that I say I have these 4 themes, so I will speak about them. But we discuss together, what do you think? what is important for your friends, and what do you think is important for you with this subject. So this is a combination of that.
So you look for material that is A, of interest to you in terms of your personal history and your personal...
Or my personal interest. Yeah.
Number one. Number two is of interest to the culture.
Yeah.
And you seem to be very energetic at making sure that the material is interesting to the culture.
It's trial and error, I think. Dostoevsky, it took me years before I gave the first lecture in a small group of about Dostoevsky, for I found him very influential of the European thinking, and so to Freud, Nietzsche, all these people, and so I spoke about Dostoevsky. And then one of the listeners of this talk, he came to me and said, why not go outside at the university and do that? I said, okay, let's look what happens. And then the interesting thing happened, non-Christians came, more than to other events.
It's a dynamic process over time.
Yes. It's not that I'm sitting at home and trying to think what is what should be the best, but it's more reaction of things when other... I'm not so... I don't have so many ideas, but when other people ask me why not, that's my typical answer, then we try it.
But you seem to have a strong inner drive to find those connections.
Yes, I want that students come in contact with the gospel. And I think one thing, a positive thing, are lectures. For if you go to a lecture, you can sit in the last row and there's no problem. It's not so easy to invite students for an evening with only a few people or to invite them for a weekend and all these things. And I have, in the years, I have often made the experience that students came for the first time as non-Christians to a lecture, and then they went to a small Bible study group and all these things. They heard first a lecture, and then and why not go into such a thing? Or go to a two-week camp. We often do in SMB two-week camps in summer times. And that I've heard often that people were on a lecture and then go to a two-week camp. And then maybe became Christian. Not in the lecture, but the lecture was the opening of what came later.
There's a question over here.
Yeah, you've been talking about lectures. I'd be interested in your thoughts about debates, because I've been involved in organizing debates in the United States a number of times, particularly creation and evolution, and had gotten the impression from some in Germany that that would not be as well received, or would somehow be too confrontational or something, and was not recommended, but instead lecture form. Do you have an opinion there? We're considering bringing in William Lane Craig for a philosophical debate on atheism or whatever. I'd be interested in your opinion of how that would work in Germany.
I have not seen so many debates in Germany, and it was an interesting point when we as these professors in Marburg sat together that the others thought it is best that we only as Christians speak. And not have this debate. I don't think that it was for the anxious.
Fear.
Fear, but I think it's a totally different situation if you have a debate. You can say that it's okay with the debate for you to see the different things, but in the debate there is another problem. It is how people wirken, how people...
The effect people have.
The effect people that have nothing to do with the argument. That is another thing of the atmosphere. That is a very problematic thing. What I am doing is always giving a lecture, and then you have the questions. So that is a debate, and often the situation afterwards sometimes is longer than my lecture. So you can say I give two lectures. First I give a lecture, and then questions. And normally the way with questions is that I first ask what questions are in the room, or not reacting to the first question. I'm doing this for when you react to the first question, then there is the problem that you mostly stay with this theme of the first question. Then the next question comes and you stay with that. If you say, okay, I will not answer the first question, are there any other questions? Then you hear a variety of questions, different questions in the room. And then that gives me the chance then to answer these questions, and then in a third round, if you want, is a direct interaction with the people. So I very seldom was part of a debate, and I'm personally not a fan of it, but that can be my problem. But I have seen that in Germany, people, Christians or professors, are not so keen for that. Mm. Maybe that will change. Maybe yeah. we'll change something.
Alexander.
Maybe I may add something to that. Because in Regensburg, we tried to do the same thing as they did in Marburg with the professors, but we wanted to have three Christian and three non-Christian. And it was no problem to find a Christian professor. But we asked about 12 atheist professors, or people who knew they were not Christians, and all of them could not come for reasons from timetable or for reasons I don't want to be part of that, or I don't want to offend other people's belief system and so on. So maybe there is this tolerance problem that Craig mentioned yesterday. You don't want to be against something. So it's hard to find atheists, I think, for such debates in Germany.
If I might make a comment too. I think one of the problems with debates in this part of the world is that often they are competitions. And Jürgen has talked about the effect, the atmosphere. It's an atmosphere of extremes in the sense that you get two opposing groups and they're putting their extremist arguments and they're having to put them quickly because in a debate, one side speaks, but it's relatively short. There's no time really to develop an argument, so that you will caricature the argument very frequently. And the same will come in the opposite direction. And what you're attempting to do is sway an audience to your side. And I suspect, and I've listened to Jürgen a number of times, that I found it my own experience, that we're out to win people's hearts and minds, not to score points. And I think that what is done in terms of giving a lecture, and I have learned this methodology from Jürgen of opening it to questions and fielding. I usually field at least six questions before I answer one. And then the debate starts. And it's a real debate because it has had a substantial background. They've heard me give a sustained argument for 50 minutes or an hour. And then they come back. I collect the questions and I immediately order them. I write them all down and order them in my mind. And I'm always looking for a personal question and I put the personal questions last. And then I will debate on a spectrum of questions. And I think if I might add to what Jürgen says, it's not only that. If you answer the first question, it stays with that theme. It's often that the most dominant person in the audience asks the first question. And other people recognize this and they groan, oh, this is going to take hours, you know, and people will go out. Whereas if you say, let's see what questions are going around in the air, then the shyer people think, goodness, I'm going to get a chance to say something. And you will notice that the dominant ones are replaced by people and the questions often get much more serious. And then you order them in your mind and you have control over the way you order them. You've also control over domination because the dominant person can't say, oh, I have another question, because you have six in front of you and the audience know all about that. And I have found this an absolutely brilliant way of getting a real debate going. And if I am to compare the sort of competitive debates that we have in the Oxford Union, which can be fun, I'm not sure that they bring a great deal of spiritual gain. And I think in the continental setting, people are wanting to listen to sustained argument, much more actually, I must confess, than in the Anglo-Saxon community. They're much more used. I mean, here, this university, last night, 90 minutes of argument, nobody moves, you see, for the lecture. I know it was with translation, but if you did 90 minutes without translation, they would still sit. It's a whole different attitude. And one of the problems in this part of the world is if you talk for too short a time, you're not serious. You haven't got anything to say. Yes?
Yeah. One question that I have is what I find to this university, and just judging from the two guys that we've had this lecture series, I find it's very hard to get the university professors to come to the lectures. And part of the reason, I don't know if you have had any experience like that, is that I think that they don't really recognize it or don't even think too much about the big authorities that come here. They just somehow, I guess they don't know the name, so they don't know the significance of an Oxford professor coming to Shokron and willing to speak on scientific themes, especially if the word Christianity appears. And I don't know if you've had any similar experience, and if you have any idea how to get these people to move or something like that.
That is similar in Germany, but even if there are big events, say three evenings, each evening 400 or 500 students, nearly no professor is coming. No. The exception can be this Peter Hegele from Ulm, which we mentioned, physics professor in Ulm. He speaks on the subject, is the cosmos made for man? That is a debate now, an open debate. It was in Der Spiegel in Germany on the title. That is an open debate. He speaks there as professor from Ulm. And then when the group is good, the SMD group, the ICF group, then they go to the physics department and tell the professors there that this man is coming. And in his lectures, often professors come to his lecture and have a debate. And the other thing, I have heard from another professor that he had made the same experience. If you have, not in the form of a debate, but if you have several people speaking, then more colleagues, more professors are coming. That another friend, Herbert Haaf from Kassel,
yes,
he told me when he is giving a lecture in Kassel at university, no one of his colleagues is coming. But when he is sitting with two, three other colleagues and they discuss the thing, not in a confrontative way, but three people speaking about the subject, then colleagues come. Maybe they fear that the lecture is not so good and they don't like to say this to the colleague. But if there are three or four, they can say, oh, it was very nice, and three or four.
Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt. Is it three or four lectures at the same time, short presentations?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's coffee time, isn't it?
I want to encourage us to have coffee before
yeah.
the workshop.
Yeah, I want to say one thing, though. Richard, I want to say something to Laszlo's question, which I think is very important. What I find is this. It depends who is organizing the lecture. If professors see that the lecture is organized by one, a student group, two, a church group, no. In Oxford, for example, recently, I gave a lecture to students on science and faith at lunchtime. 800 came, which shows the interest in that topic. Place, town hall was completely packed. Not a single professor. But if the university organizes a lecture, which I gave, for example, 3 weeks ago, then the professors come because they are completely allergic to anything that's put on by Christian organizations. And usually I try, if I'm in any given situation, to make sure the organization is done by academics internally. And no name of any church group or anything like that appears
that's
anywhere near.
Exactly what we've done. We're still not seeing that.
Yeah.
That's crucial.
Well, I want to add this to what John is saying. And Jürgen, it is culture dependent. We did a student group, an IFES student group in Ukraine, and Kiev did this. They scheduled a symposium late in the afternoon on intelligent design, and there were professors there. So I think that the allergic reaction of professors can be culture dependent to some extent.
Oh, of course it is. Yes, of course it is.
I think in addition to what this is, you say is look at your culture and find out what the rules are for people's behavior there so to know how to do it.
I also have to add that I'm more confident.
Well, this is the last morning session in the scientific network, and I want to say some remarks about things that I myself have found helpful and try to encourage all of us to get on with the work of entering the world of science and discussion in order to communicate the Christian faith. And I think it's always important to remind ourselves of some of our basic goals. Apologetics, as all of us know, is the defense of the Christian message. It's the defense of the Christian message against the background of competing worldviews. And as we think of those, there is a sense in which they reduce themselves to three. We're dealing with three basic worldviews, as James Sire points out in his book, The Universe Next Door. And sometimes I find it helpful in communication. And what I want to do is not give a presentation like I would do to the general public, but to encourage you with some of the things that I have found useful, but to comment on them as I go along. So, thinking of the three major worldviews, sometimes I find it interesting for an audience to start by saying either the universe is an illusion or it is not. If it is an illusion, Maya, then we have the pantheist worldview. But if it's not an illusion, if the universe is real, then there are two possibilities. Either it is all that there is, and that's the materialistic worldview, or else it's not all that there is, and that is the theistic worldview. And I've discovered that that's a very useful orientation for audiences of all kinds, because it reduces from the vast apparent multiplicity of worldviews to three essential positions. And they can then relate what you're saying to those three worldviews. And Christian theism is claiming, one, that the universe is real, but secondly, it bears evidence as to its origin. Because for me, the bottom line in apologetics at this level is the claim by the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans that since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that they are without excuse. Now, the importance of this text is sometimes not realized, because this is Paul explaining to the capital city of Rome what the Christian message is. And his argument is a very logical one. He says that he's not ashamed of the gospel. Why is he not ashamed? Because it's the power of God to salvation. Oh, do people need to be saved then? Indeed they do, he says. The wrath of God is revealed against all righteousness. Because human beings are not only sinners, they are guilty sinners. Really? What constitutes them guilty? One, there is evidence in creation. Two, there is evidence in conscience. Three, there is evidence in the Word of God. And you will notice that he starts with his evidence for the guilt of humanity by pointing to creation and concludes in the last phrase here, therefore they are without excuse. In other words, according to Paul, the evidence of creation is so powerful that it constitutes people without excuse. Now that seems to me to be enormously important. So that we have a basis for getting out there as a first step in explaining the Christian message is appealing to the traces that God has left in creation. Point number two is, they are not proved by creation, they are perceived. There is a difference. Perception is not the same as proof. You get proof in mathematics, perception is a much wider concept. So then, the claim is that there are traces of God in the universe. And some scientists go along with that and some don't. Give you an example of two. Firstly, Sir Gillian Prance. Arguably one of the most distinguished botanists of the 20th century, director of Kew Gardens, fellow of the Royal Society, and knighted by the Queen for his services to science. For many years, I have believed that God is the great designer behind all nature. I made a commitment to Christ as my personal savior while a student at Oxford. All my studies since then have confirmed my faith. I regard the Bible as my principal source of authority. So there is a distinguished academician, fellow of the Royal Society, who believes what Paul says. Here's the exact opposite, Stephen Jay Gould. Before Darwin, we thought that a benevolent God had created us. No intervening spirit watches lovingly over the affairs of nature. No vital forces propel evolutionary change. Here comes the important bit. Whatever we think of God, his existence is not manifested in the products of nature. Now, the interesting thing about those two statements is they are statements by distinguished scientists. And we need to reflect about the implications of that fact, because it shows instantly that the battle is not between science and religion. That is so important. It's such an elementary fact that people find it difficult to see. They are both positional statements by distinguished scientists. So the battle can't be between science and faith in God. It can't. The conflict is not between science and belief in God. It is a worldview conflict with scientists on all sides. You will get scientists who are materialists. You will get scientists who are pantheists. And you will get scientists who are theists. That point bears very careful explanation. Because my experience is this, that if you can get over the caricature, get past the caricature that science is at war with religion, you get an audience listening to you much more seriously. Much more seriously. It becomes a completely different kind of dialogue with your audience. So that the real question that we're posing is this. It's not, is science in conflict with religion? It's which worldview fits best with what we know of science. We have our three worldviews, we have science, and we ask ourselves, which worldview fits best with science? That's the question that I have found the most useful to get across to people for setting the parameters of the debate. Okay, so then you can begin to present the case for theism. And I usually start with the history of science. First time I ever lectured on this in Siberia, the people listening were angry. The professors were really angry, not with me, but because they'd never been told before that the leading figures in the explosion of science of the 16th and 17th centuries were all theists. They believed in God. Now, the question is, why? And people argue about this. But Sir Alfred North Whitehead, cited by C.S. Lewis, men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in the lawgiver. In other words, the origin of modern science had a lot to do with Christian theism. And that's not simply the opinion of North Whitehead. It is the opinion of Melvin Calvin, who's the Nobel Prize winner for biochemistry. As I try to discern the origin of that conviction that the universe is orderly, I seem to find it in a basic notion discovered 2,000 to 3,000 years ago and enunciated first in the Western world by the ancient Hebrews, namely that the universe is governed by a single God, and he's not the product of the whims of many gods, each governing his own province according to his own laws. This monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation for modern science. I find that a very useful thing to point out. With people who will debate this thesis, and there are some, I come to the bottom line, which is this. It's that certainly their belief in God didn't hinder their science. And in fact, the concept of an ordered creation in a de-deified universe is a very important notion. Now, if I have time, I would trace that back to the ancient Greek philosophers. And their idea that you got rid of the gods and spirits in the universe in order to study it. But people like Xenophanes did not make the mistake that many people make, is that you get rid of God with a capital G. You get rid of the gods so that you're free to study the universe. You'd be careful in studying an eclipse of the moon if you thought a god was behind it. Once you de-deify it, you're free to study it. but don't make the mistake of removing God with the gods. Now, that's a whole area of debate and is very useful in its own right. So now, having said something about history, I would want to say something about the limits and fundamental assumptions of science before ever getting near the evidences that the sciences bring. Because it seems to me that there's preliminary work to be done, which is enormously powerful in getting across to people, at least in my experience, that there's something here to be thought about. First of all, the limits. And at one extreme, there is the view of scientism, expressed famously by Bertrand Russell, who ought to have known better. And he says, whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. Now, Russell, I respect greatly. I enjoy his books on philosophy. I respect him as a mathematician, but somehow he seems to have become incoherent at this point. Because this sentence, this statement, is not a scientific statement. So it can't be true if it is true. Because he says, whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods. But this claims knowledge which is not scientific. So it's false if it's true. In other words, it's logically incoherent. It's logically incoherent. It proves too much. And Sir Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, puts it much better. He says, the existence of a limit to science, in a brilliant book that everybody who's interested in this topic should read, called The Limits of Science, called by Sir Peter Medawar. The limits of science. The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike elementary questions having to do with first and last things. Questions such as, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living? And I often use an illustration at this point, which is so simple that I find that most professors can understand it. And that's of, I imagine my aunt has baked a cake, and you have won the Nobel Prize, and people like to think of themselves as Nobel Prize winners. And they analyze the cake scientifically. And then I ask them, as the chairman, why did she make the cake? And invite the biochemist to comment. He can't, neither can the physicist or the chemist. And she starts to smile, because she knows, of course. But unless she reveals to us why she made the cake, we'll never know. And that helps me get across to an audience the conceptual difference between reading the book of nature and the concept of revelation. And it enables me to raise the big question, which is there something, or perhaps better, someone, who stands in relation to the universe, in the same relation to the universe as Aunt Matilda does to the cake? And that enables me, if I have time, to point out the difference between revelation and reason, and to point out that they do not contradict each other. That's one of the popular myths. The point is that we're talking about different sources of information, and we use reason on both of them. You can't even read the Bible without using your reason, you know. Reason we use to read the book of nature. Reason we use to read the other book of God, the Bible. It's not that you switch off reason when you're reading one and not the other. That's absurd. But the question is there a category of revelation? That is where unaided reason can't reach. It can work on the information once it's got it, but it can't get it. And I just raise that problem and say to people, well, of course you can assume that such a realm does not exist, but then you're shutting yourself in to, you're closing down the possibilities. You can do that if you like, of course. But that's a limitation you're artificially imposing. And what happens now when the evidence begins to point the other way? So that, having talked about the limits of science, I now come to the methodology of science and its fundamental beliefs. Because here again, we're meeting a fundamental difficulty because people imagine naively that science has got the facts, religion has got faith, and therefore it's not worth thinking about. So I want to point out that all scientists are believers in something. And what do they believe in? Basically, number one, the rational intelligibility of the universe. Einstein, I cannot imagine any scientist without this faith. And Eugene Wigner, in a very famous essay that every mathematician ought to read, and some others too, in 1961, wrote a thing about the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. How is it that a mathematician thinking in here can work out something that describes the universe out there? That is unreasonable. Well, why is it unreasonable? Doesn't physics explain it? No. As my teacher of quantum physics at Cambridge points out in one of his books, John Polkinghorne, physics is powerless to explain its fundamental belief in the mathematical intelligibility of the universe. Why? Because you have to believe in the intelligibility of the universe in order to do physics in the first place. It's a fundamental belief. Now, with which worldview does it fit best? Now, I find this one of the most important questions to deal with. Long before you come to fine-tuning, evolution, or anything else, science itself. Let's take the materialistic worldview, which is dependent on a bottom-up reductionistic explanation of everything. Not methodological reductionism, which we all use in science, break up a big problem into small pieces, study them separately, that's fine. If we're talking about ontological reductionism, life and everything else is nothing but physics and chemistry. So that's the view. So let's take it to its extreme. Francis Crick's famous book, An Astonishing Hypothesis. You, your joys, sorrows, your memories, ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Well, that is an astonishing hypothesis. Astonishing because if it were true, we couldn't know it. Think about it. He makes it less astonishing in the rest of the book where he says you are largely a collection of atoms. Ha ha. And it has been brilliantly analyzed by Fraser Watt in Cambridge. There's a very useful little article on it. And as Holden pointed out long before, if my mental processes are determined solely by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. In particular, I have no reason to believe that my brain is composed of atoms. You see, it proves too much. It's like Bertrand Russell. By saying science is omniscient and gives us everything, you're saying gives us nothing. By reducing it to materialistic bases, you're undermining rationality. So there's my reason for not being a materialist. It's got nothing in that sense immediately to do with my faith in God. It's got to do with my scientific methodology. And I find that a very powerful consideration to bring to bear on people. That materialism and science don't fit at the level of the very thing we need to do our science. And Polkinghorne makes a comment on that. But of course it sits very well with theism, doesn't it? Because what Wigner says is unreasonable is from the Christian theist view very reasonable. Because it's saying that the reason the universe is mathematically intelligible is that the universe out there and the human mind in here have both been created by the same God. That makes sense. And this is one of the criteria for truth in the epistemological sense, coherence. And that will become something important a bit later on. It is very important to emphasize coherence and explanatory power as criteria of truth and not simplicity only. Einstein said, let things be simple, but only as simple as necessary. Quantum electrodynamics ain't simple. Is it? Why do people believe it then? Because of its explanatory power, not because of its simplicity. That is a thing to hold in our minds until we get a little bit further down. Next thing I like to talk about is the nature of explanation. The nature of explanation. And the first thing is to try to get people to see the distinction between explanations in terms of law and mechanism on the one side and in terms of agency on the other side. Because very frequently, the kind of argument you get promoting atheism can be reduced to this. We have discovered mechanism X, therefore there is no God. That's a very curious line of argument, isn't it? Whatever mechanism X is, and however many random processes it may involve, mechanism X exists, therefore there is no God. In other words, we didn't have an explanation before, now we've got an explanation, we filled a gap, therefore there's no need of God. It is an inverted God of the gaps reasoning. The very interesting thing, folks, is this, that as Christians, we are frequently accused of God of the gaps thinking. But let's first of all observe that many atheists think in terms of a God of the gaps. It's the way they think, because God disappears the moment they have an explanation. But that's absurd. When Isaac Newton discovered gravitation, he didn't say, well, that's marvelous, we don't need God now. We got gravitation. That's ridiculous. In fact, his worship was increased by discovering a bit more of the genius of God that he didn't know before. The existence of a mechanism does not of itself logically imply the absence of an agent. In fact, it usually implies the presence of an agent. And so we have to distinguish between those two things very carefully and give numerous examples of them and think them out for ourselves. The next difficulty in this whole area of explanation is explaining how something works is not necessarily the same as explaining how it came to exist in the first place. Because I'm a mathematician, many people like to quote Laplace to me, je n'ai pas besoin de cette hypothèse. I don't need that hypothesis, which he said to Napoleon when he was explaining his ballistic equations to him. He was perfectly right, of course. In my mathematics classes on group theory, I don't say, now God fits in here, by the way. You notice it? Of course not. If you're describing how a mechanism works, if you're describing how a jet engine works, you don't mention Frank Whittle. If you're describing how it came to exist, you do. If Napoleon had asked the question to Laplace, Professor Laplace, how does it come to be that there is a universe which is describable by these laws? That's a very different question, isn't it? And often there's confusion. Firstly, agency is confused with mechanism. And secondly, the question, how things come to exist, is confused with how they work. Now, the question, how things come to exist, is actually a historical question to a large extent, and is frequently not open to the kind of repeated experimentation which in most people's minds categorizes science. That distinction needs to be made because often they give the same weight to speculations about etiology, about historical development, as they do to something that's based on experimentation. And it needs to be made clear to them that this is not the case very frequently. I do not deny that science explains, writes Richard Swinburne, professor of philosophy at Oxford, but I postulate God to explain why science explains. The very success of science in showing us how deeply orderly the natural world is provides strong grounds for believing that there's an even deeper cause for that order. All right? Now, I have found up to this point, I haven't mentioned fine-tuning, I haven't mentioned evolution, I haven't mentioned intelligent design. But even if that's all I get saying, that can open up a superb discussion. Because it seems to me, and I'm open to your comments afterwards, I'll give the presentation in full first of all, that These are some of the substantive issues that apply right across the board. And then, having done that, and said, right, the level of scientific methodology, the rational intelligibility of the universe, and so on, that seems to sit much better with theism than with atheism. What about traces of God in creation itself? Let's have a look at them. And in the back of my mind is what the Bible says about them. I don't always say this publicly, but in the back of my mind, I have a set of categories that are given to me by Scripture. One, that God is the creator. Two, that he is the upholder. And that those two are not necessarily the same thing. That creation is not necessarily to be understood as Augustine understood it. That is a kind of backwards extrapolation of providence. Three, that God is responsible, therefore, because he's the creator, for the structures, laws, and regularities of the universe. God makes the sun to shine, in biblical language. But he's not a prisoner of those laws and regularities. Now, we discussed this yesterday. I'm not going to repeat it again. But it is quite clear that there are miracles, which C.S. Lewis calls miracles of the old creation, and miracles of the new creation. Miracles of the old creation, where you do see at certain levels that part, at least, of the cause-effect web is used. A great wind blew at the Red Sea. Water was turned into wine, and so on. But then there are the miracles of the new creation, like the incarnation and resurrection, where you do not even begin to explain them in terms of a backwards extrapolated cause-effect web. They are the introduction of something from outside into the system that God has created. Now, that's at the back of my mind, because I'm aware that there are these three different levels. And it's a good thing not to confuse them in people's minds. There is, of course, prayer and guidance at the very practical level of everyday life in Christian experience. So traces of God. On the basis of what Scripture says, what would you expect? I think that's a very important question to ask ourselves. What would you expect to find? Well, one, I'd expect to find that there's evidence of God in the whole show and its behavior, macro and micro, in the anthropic coincidences. That is, not in the bits we don't understand, but the bits we do. The more we discover of the mechanisms, of the wonder, of how the universe works, the more we worship the God who made it. So the whole show. The heavens declare the glory of God. Secondly, in the footprint of a limited number of special space-time occurrences where God introduces something new into the universe. That's what I'd expect from the biblical perspective. So that as a corollary, and here's the crunch, to any paradigm that assumes a priori that such activity is impossible, these occurrences will look like singularities. Now that's important, because there is a very big question in people's minds as to what are the singularities, even among Christians. The resurrection is the central singularity from which you start working backwards. The incarnation is a singularity. Is creation a singularity like that? That's a question for many people, even Christians. It seems to me, to be open about my own position, is that this is one of those singularities. It doesn't self-generate. But that there's more than one of them. Because the Genesis account indicates that God speaks on a number of occasions. The fascinating thing about the account is that the Bible does not claim he did it all at once. That's the interesting thing. That there's a sequence which stops. So I would expect there to be a limited number. And I would suggest that at least one of those, going to the bottom line, is not only the origin of the universe, which many physicists admit, until the last issue of Scientific American at least, many physicists admit to be a singularity. The Hawking-Penrose discussion. But life, is that a singularity? That is, that the naturalistic paradigm hasn't got the explanatory power to deal with it. Now, that is a question that I feel is very important for scientific investigation, and of course we've heard some of it these days. So the first thing is you've got cosmology, physics, and chemistry, and the fine-tuning arguments. Now, William Lane Craig and various others have discussed those. I'm going to say nothing about them except to say that these days, fine-tuning arguments make sense to people. But if you use them, and I find this particular quotation one of the most useful by Arno Penzias, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the microwave background. Astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe made out of nothing, with the precise fine-tuning which is necessary for life and which has, one might say, an underlying supernatural plan. That's a very interesting statement. But if you use these fine-tuned arguments these days, certainly in Oxford, you'll be faced with many worlds. This fine-tuning, writes Mark Tegmark of Princeton in The New Scientist 98, has two possible explanations. Either the universe was designed specifically for us by a creator, or there is a multiverse. There are many worlds. Now, you physicists know far more about this than I do. The interesting thing about the many worlds postulate is that, for some physicists at least, it finds a basis in quantum mechanics. In the Hugh Everett interpretation of quantum mechanics. And there is a number, certainly in Oxford, I know them, of very serious, of very bright physicists who believe in the many worlds interpretation. Some of our senior scientists believe in this, and one of my friends, who's a philosopher of physics, is completely convinced of it. David Deutsch, who's working in Oxford, has done a lot of work on this, and it gets, of course, enormously hyped up. You need to ask a lot of very hard questions. But I'm simply saying to you that this is something that you will come up against and need to think seriously about. Now, you will notice that an alternative is offered here. That need not be the case, of course. How does Tegmark know that even if there are many universes, that all of them have not been created by God? Interestingly, my friend who's the philosopher of physics, Michael Lockwood in Oxford, a very well-known philosopher of physics, he says that the fine-tuning arguments are not diminished by the multiverse interpretation because the probabilities are being worked out in this universe. And that's worth thinking about. That's worth thinking about. But I'm not going to go into many worlds at all. I'd just like to point out to you, though, a very interesting thing that's happened in the history of science. We started with geocentric Aristotle and Ptolemy. Then man became smaller with the heliocentric view. We're going around the sun. Then we discover our sun is one amongst many, so man has been banished to the periphery of the universe. But then we discover that even in the galaxy, there's only one galaxy among many, many galaxies. So man becomes extremely small, and then we suddenly get fine-tuning, and man comes right into the middle again. Isn't that interesting? You suddenly get the anthropic principle. So man is hurtled from the edge of the universe into the middle, but you better get rid of him again, so you better have our universe one among many. It's quite an interesting development philosophically, isn't it? And I find it quite amusing to point this out to people, just what is happening here, you see. Okay, then there's biology, which is famously defined by Richard Dawkins as the study of complicated mechanisms which give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And He tells us that natural selection, the blind, unconscious, automatic process, is the explanation for the existence and apparently purposeful form of all life. It has no purpose in mind. It's the blind watchmaker. Now, here, we need to do a lot of very hard thinking. How do we tackle this kind of thing? And I can only say what I have found useful. Number one is to investigate the ambiguity of the language. Look at the language. Unconscious automatic process. Forget that you're thinking of natural selection and mutation, which is controversial, as we've seen in the last few days. Forget it. Just think you're thinking of a mechanism. It's blind. It's unconscious. It's automatic. Let me hold up a mechanism which has all three properties. It's blind, it's unconscious, and it's automatic. Therefore, it hasn't been designed. There's something funny about the argument, isn't there? Because you see, this is very subtle. Do you notice the blindness is in the process? And then the process gets personified, the blind watchmaker. And the impression is given that he's dealt with agency simultaneously to dealing with mechanism, but he hasn't. He's simply cheated and tricked the reader into deducing from the fact, the admitted fact, that a process is blind, automatic, and unconscious, that it has not been designed. He hasn't dealt with the problem of whether it's been designed or not. Now, that is very important, and many people miss it. And it takes careful analysis. Because, you see, before you ever begin to discuss the mechanics of evolution, you need to discuss the logic of the argument. To my mind, this is utterly crucial. And no amount of discussing mechanism, if you haven't discussed this in continental Europe, will get you anywhere. It just won't. So what happens is, you see, that the view is that design is only apparent. Evolution and design by a creative intelligence are mutually exclusive. That is the impression that's given. So Darwin not only demolishes design arguments based on biology, he proves atheism. That's the position. Some people resent it being put as strongly as that, but that appears to be the position. You're deducing atheism from biology. That brings me now to point number two. Point number two is that those two things that I just mentioned are in different categories. Biology is a scientific discipline. Atheism is a worldview. And that ought to send our lights flashing in our logical apparatus up here. You see, in order to be able to deduce atheism from Darwinism, you have to have two simultaneously valid propositions, not just one. A logical proposition has to be valid, and a scientific proposition has to be valid. What's the logical proposition? You see, people often go straight for the second and miss the first. And therefore, the second is ineffective. The first proposition is, logically, you will have to prove, in order to deduce atheism from Darwinism, that biological evolution is incompatible with the existence of a creator. You'll have to prove that first. And secondly, and simultaneously, at the scientific level, evolution will have to exhaustively be capable of accounting for the existence and form of all life's complexity. Now, it took me a long time to understand that the first step is vital in the European context. Because, you see, at the level of logic, they are not incompatible. The mechanism of natural selection and mutation does something, doesn't it? If you look around this room and look at our differences and ask what accounts for them, there are selective processes at work, and rather sadly, there are mutation processes at work, from which probably a third of us will die from a genetic disease caused by an adverse mutation. So they do something, yes? Suppose they did everything, just for a moment. Could you deduce absence of agency from existence of mechanism? Of course not. It's a fundamental category mistake. And if you just illustrate it with evolution, the audience will not understand it as clearly as if you first illustrated it with something that's not emotionally controversial, like gravity or something like this, you see, and Newton. If I discover, at least, if I've illustrated it there, then people will take this very seriously. I have not yet met a scientist. I've yet to meet one. An atheist, that is, who will not take this seriously. Not one. And I point out to them that Darwin originally was strongly supported by Asa Gray, who was a Christian. It's simply a fact. Because he felt that this is the way God did it. That is, he didn't logically, at the end, he didn't logically deduce that mechanism implies absence of agent. Now, we can ask a very important question that I do not hear being asked as clearly as I would perhaps like to hear it asked. You can stop at this point and say, irrespective of mechanism, does life evidence intelligent origin? Because you see, the question of intelligent input and mechanism are logically independent questions. If I go to Mars and find a sequence of titanium balls, 2, 3, 5, 7, 11, 13, in prime order, I'll immediately say intelligence. I won't know what sort of intelligence. I won't have any idea about mechanism, but I will perceive an intelligent origin, won't I? And so it is worth asking the question, irrespective of mechanism, are there evidences of intelligence? The difficulty, to my mind, is that we confuse these two questions and they get conflated. And sometimes the argument becomes a lot less effective because we're saying, well, that mechanism won't do it, and the other won't, and the other one probably might do, and it's your opinion against my opinion, and we don't know all the information anyway, so we can come to no conclusion. Ah, but we can cut through all that, can't we? And ask this question. So I point that out to you, because there are, as no doubt you are well aware, there are certain areas of science where we do perceive intelligent origin. Do you notice how I phrased that? I haven't said intelligent design. Do you know why? Because I have discovered that the word design, to many scientists, immediately makes them think of an architect and a clockwork universe. And they can't get rid of that idea. And everything afterwards you say is, oh, he's talking about the clockwork universe, but that's long since gone with quantum mechanics and everything else. And they've missed the point. If I say intelligent origin, they're with me. It's not that I am against the use of the word design, but I see a certain difficulty that we can avoid because it's loaded with concepts that we don't want to discuss at this point. Does that make sense? And I find that a very useful point. So I talk about these various things that forensic medicine and so on and so forth, where scientifically we want to distinguish between chance necessity and intelligent input. Now, say that to my colleagues in Oxford, and they say, oh, come on. You see, you clearly haven't been reading our stuff. You're not listening. Because what we are saying about this mechanism is it's different from all other mechanisms. It designs without having itself been designed. So your argument falls. See? Dan Dennett, particularly. But Dawkins and that whole realm. And I sympathize with their argument. And tell them so. Say, so I see your point. Absolutely. That's why I must come to deal with mechanism. See, some people argue, leave it there. Don't get messed up with mechanism because you're going to run into the accusation of God of the gaps. But the problem is, if you do leave it there, you run into the accusation of a superfluous God. What a clever God, as someone once said to me. You know, you've got a very clever God, some of you Christians. He's so clever that he's obliterated all trace of his presence and worked through a process that bears zero trace of his presence, namely macroevolution. Well, I sympathize with that. So you see, I want to ask my second question. And the second question now is, does the mechanism that is put forward bear the weight that's put on it? That is a legitimate question, it seems to me. Does the postulated mechanism bear the weight that's put on it? Now, there's an awful lot at stake, and this is also a very big dimension in the argument. Worldview is at stake because, although my first step was you cannot deduce atheism from Darwinism, you can deduce Darwinism from atheism. You can go the other way around, as Lucretius and the ancient Greek philosophers saw. Lucretius was a Latin poet, by the way, not a Greek philosopher. But Lucretius was faced with Democritus' view of the universe. There are atoms, there is the void. Please explain life. And he worked out a brilliant evolutionary theory, so brilliant that he got every point Darwin got except the transmutation of species. And that's 2,000 or so years ago. We ought all to read Lucretius's book, De Rerum Natura, in English if you can't read Latin. Because it is a brilliant example of how you can deduce a worldview that is now called a scientific worldview from straight materialistic philosophy. So that, on the basis of logic, you see, if macroevolution is false, it's not simply, oh, well, we replace it by a new scientific... No. Macroevolution is false, materialism is false. Because materialism, as an assumption, implies macroevolution. Now, that is unique in science, and I like to point that out to people. This is the only place I know in science, tell me if you know another one, where a reigning scientific theory is directly deducible from a philosophy without any evidence. You cannot deduce the fact that the Earth rotates in an elliptical orbit round the sun from materialism, can you? You cannot deduce that carbon resonates at certain frequencies from materialism, can you? But you can deduce that evolution has happened from materialism because it's the only option. Now, that indicates to me why this area is so complicated. And it's worth bearing it in mind. That we're dealing with, in the sense of falsifiability with Popper, with a falsifiable theory. Peace be to some people that suggest that evolution is not falsifiable. It is. Darwin himself saw that in The Origin of Species, and Michael Behe has taken it up. As you know, whether he succeeded is still being hotly debated. But he's taken up the challenge. If it could be shown that there is a biological organism which could not possibly have come about by numerous small accretions, then my theory completely breaks down. That's falsifiability. And that is why it's so serious. That if macroevolution, not micro, because we're not, that happens, we can observe that. So evolution does something. And incidentally, that's why the debate gets in such a mess. Because what some people mean by evolution is not controversial at all. And if that's what you're talking about, you get nowhere. You need to explain that evolution has, in fact, five different meanings. And you need to select which one you're talking about. But I think you're all aware of that. I want to deal with this philosophical point. And it is so important to see it and to understand it. Because if we don't, we won't see why we get into such difficulty in this area. We just won't see why. Materialism is false if blind, unguided processes, not processes that are in themselves blind, but processes that are unguided, that's different, can account for the existence of life. And the thing I concentrate on, I'm coming to an end now very quickly, is the origin of information, because that's nearest to me as a mathematician, and the origin of life itself. And I ask the question now in a reformulated form. Does the mechanism bear the weight of creating biological information? And now we would need to talk about emergence. Because emergence is another of these buzzwords that means a whole lot of different things. And they need to be spelled out. Do you mean emergence from structure, like salt equals sodium plus chlorine? No energy needed. Or do you mean structure plus energy, amino acids, hydrogen plus nitrogen plus carbon? Or do you mean structure plus energy plus input of information, like word processing emerges from a computer? You see, which do you mean? And we hear this word emergence, and it's rarely ever analyzed into its different parts. That needs to be done. The self-organization notions, Eigen's algorithms, Prigogine's dynamical systems, all of this, which inadequately, and I am quoting Holmes Rolston, this year's winner of the Templeton Prize, very interestingly, he gave a lecture at Oxford in which he said this, what is inadequately, just last week or the week before, what is inadequately recognized in the self-organizing accounts is that although no new matter energy is needed for such spontaneous organization, new information is needed in enormous quantities, and one cannot just let that information float in from nowhere. Now, he's an evolutionist, so this is all the more interesting. Over evolutionary history, something is going on over the heads of any and of all of the local individual organisms. More comes from less again and again. A more plausible explanation is that complementing the self-organizing, there is a ground of information or an ambience of information, otherwise known as God. And he warned the people in Oxford not to dismiss intelligent design thinkers too prematurely. That I found a very interesting thing. That here we have someone who's aware that information is not reducible to matter and energy. Now, because I'm a mathematician, I usually go to the heart of the blind watchmaker argument and analyze it from an information theoretic point of view. His famous typing monkeys producing the Shakespearean phrase, methinks it is like a weasel. I needn't go through that. If anybody's interested, I'll go through it later. But it's very interesting applying it to the human genome and having 3.5 billion monkeys sitting in a row typing, A, C, G, or T. By the Dawkins mechanism, they produce the human genome in its entirety to a very high probability within 80 attempts, 80. Of course they do, because what the information contained in the genome is already written into the mechanism. It is a highly intelligently designed mechanism. And his argument proves the exact opposite of what he wants to prove. The amount of information generated by his mechanism is zero because the probability of reaching the genome is one. To paraphrase him, his mechanism generates the appearance of information. But that's another story. That usually leads me, I sometimes talk about linguistics because there's a lot of evidence from linguistics, by the way, that Darwin was totally wrong when he made the famous statement that the origin of life parallels the origin of language. That is totally wrong in the way he formulated it. He thought that language is developed from primitive language. Noam Chomsky, of whom you've all heard, said this to the astonishment of the linguistic world not long ago. It is perfectly safe to attribute this development of innate language structures to natural selection. So long as we realize that there is no substance to this assertion, that it amounts to nothing more than a belief that there's some naturalistic explanation for these phenomena. He talks about a big bang, hardwired for language, which is very interesting in this context. Well, finally, God of the gaps. We need to analyze the concept of a gap. Because, you see, there are two kinds, as far as I can see. There are gaps that can be closed by science, and there are gaps that can be opened by science. We need to distinguish. Now, when we're talking about the origin of life, is it a gap that can be closed by science? Or is it something that science is increasingly showing us is beyond the reductionist explanatory power of physics and chemistry? And that is then a very crucial discussion. Is information an irreducible quantity? Some physicists now are following the line of Wheeler. Anton Zeilinger, very interestingly, one of the world's leading quantum teleportation experts in a huge school in Vienna, one of the world's top quantum physicists, is now suggesting that quantum mechanics, the idea of quantum, comes from the fact that the fundamental of unit of information is quantized a bit, yes or no? That information is primary, in the beginning was the bit, and that matter and energy are derivative. Now that is fascinating to me. And I talk about that and point out to people that that's exactly what the beginning of John says, in the beginning was the Word. And there are your two worldviews, at least the two that we mainly have to deal with. In the beginning was the Word, and matter and energy are derivative, or in the beginning were the particles, and information is derivative. Which makes more sense? The way science is moving, I find really exciting. And if I might just mention a practical thing, I find Roger Sperry's argument brilliant. Michael Pollan uses it, but I use it in a very simple way. And I was mentioning to some of the others something that's happened to me many, many times. I'm sitting with a scientist, and they tell me they're reductionist, everything's explainable in terms of physics and chemistry, and I just pick up a menu from the dining table and says, explain to me, please, the semiotics of the letters on this menu in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. And I had a top biochemist who leads one of the most eminent biochemical research groups in the world say to me, it can't be done. He said, you know, for 40 years I've gone into my laboratory in Oxford thinking it could be done, but it can't. And I was so surprised that I went over onto the opposition and said, but physics and chemistry have only been going for a few hundred years. He said, doesn't matter. You have to introduce a higher level explanation. But I said, that's an author of the gaps then, isn't it? No, he said, it isn't. The nature of the complexity of those signs demands a higher level explanation. Now, I found that a very interesting thing to deal with this God of the gaps thing. I say, I find a curious thing, you know. I go with a Chinese archaeologist into a cave in Hunan province in China, and I'm coming along the cave, and suddenly on the wall we notice that written. And the archaeologist says, human intelligence. I say, don't be so stupid. What a silly deduction. That's only a simple symbol. It's a, you know, two strokes. That's no explanation at all. Because you're postulating something more complex than the thing you're explaining, aren't you? That's Richard Dawkins' argument, by the way, these days. We call it the North Oxford argument. Using God is no explanation for anything, because by definition, God is more complex than the thing you're explaining. But just half a minute. Apply that to this. The archaeologist looks at me and says, but you see, you may think that that's simple. That's actually the Chinese character for a human being. Nothing less than the complexity of a human intelligence will explain it. Now notice the way the perception works. It immediately infers upwards to the more complex thing. Isn't that curious? How many strokes are there? Two. And yet the brightest brains in the world sit in front of a 3.4 billion sequence of letters in perfect order and say chance and necessity. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, there's something curious happening here. Something very curious. Isn't there? So that's the kind of argument I find useful. And what it does, it leaves me with the Word. And that's very important. Because you see, what we are about is trying to get across the notion that what Scripture says makes sense. And the reason I concentrate on the Word is that if you ask yourself, what is the thing that is most emphasized in Scripture about creation, it is that it was done by the Word of God. It says it all over the place. Look up all the statements in Scripture. So I take it that that is the thing to concentrate on and get across to people. What we're doing is standing, communicating the notion that there is a word behind this universe. The universe makes sense. There is a God who is the Word. And Genesis, in its simple but very profound way, says it so clearly that we often don't see it. And God said. I was talking to a world-famous astrophysicist, Chandra, Wick Ramasinghe, he wouldn't mind me telling you. And he'd been hauled over to the States on a creation trial. And they hadn't quite realized whom they had invited over. And he said, you know, he said, the Christians were very nice to me and the atheists were horrible. But he said, it's such a pity that these Christians are so naive. I said, oh, really? Yes, he said, they believe the Bible, you know, John. Well, I said, so do I. Well, he said, you're not one of them, are you? He said, you're not one of them. And he threw me his chalk. I'll never forget it. He threw me his chalk. I was in his room. And he said, prove it to me. So I went over and I wrote, and God said, let there be light. And he said, ha ha, you are one of them. He said, that's absurd. That's absurd. Well, I said, just for you, Chandra, let me put it in different language. So I wrote this down. In the beginning was the Word. All things were made by him. He said, what does that mean? Well, I said, logos. It's a word in Greek for word, utterance, command. Said it's the word the Stoics use for the rational principle behind the universe, on which we do science. It's the word the Christians then use to describe the second person of the Godhead, God become flesh. I said, you know, word, logos, logic, information, code. He said, what did you say? Did you say information? I said, yes. He said, does the Bible have the concept of information? I said, what does it look like? I said, actually, it's even more interesting than that, because, and I wrote this down in his blackboard. By faith we understand that the worlds were made by the Word of God, so that what is seen is not made out of what was visible. I said, Chandra, if the New Testament is so primitive, as some people think, how did they know 20 centuries ago that information is invisible? He said, does Sir Fred Hoyle know about this? I said, I don't know. And he said, we better tell him because he's never mentioned it to me. And we did, but that's another story. But you see, this is very powerful. And often in the Christian world, we're so familiar with these statements, we're not aware of their power. This is very powerful. Oddly enough, here we have materialism trying to explain the world bottom up, and we live to the century where we discover that the human cell is packed with information which itself is immaterial. Information is not material, is it? You need to think about that, because this is a hot debate at the moment. Is information material or not? Usually you see information is carried on material carriers, as you see here, but it itself is not immaterial. So we have this curious thing that what has come to be at the heart is an immaterial concept that all the materialists believe in. That's worth pointing out, isn't it? Now, final thing. And with this, I would encourage you. What's our bottom line? We're trying to get people to take the Word seriously. And I usually drop in the talk the fact that I am a Christian theist. And when I collect the questions in the manner we described earlier, afterwards, I'm hoping that the following question is going to come up, and it comes up 9 times out of 10. And people say, well, now, Dr. Lennox, that's a very interesting lecture. But you see, logically, it bothers me a little bit. Because let's suppose that your arguments are valid. They certainly take us along the direction of a credible and plausible belief in an intelligent origin, in an intelligent God. But I think I noticed you say you were a Christian. That doesn't logically follow, does it? And I say, no, it doesn't. But now that you've asked me a personal question, let me explain to you why I am a Christian. Now, I have found as a strategy that if you introduce Christianity in the last 5 minutes of your talk and change the gear of your talk, you lose most of your audience. And what they'll say to you is typical of these Christians. They use the opportunity. They're not really interested in the science. This is what they're interested in, and they go blank. So I leave it for the question time. And I find that makes a vast difference. If someone has asked you why you're a Christian, then you can say, well, you've asked me a personal question, therefore I'm going to give you a personal answer. And I say the next step to this is absolutely, you've asked the right question, because the next step is facing the claim, the Word became flesh and lived among us. And then I go on to talk about that, and I usually find as possible. As I said, I was in an atomic research establishment last week. 500 people came to the lecture, some of the brightest physicists in Britain, by definition. And I was able to explain that to them. I think it's very important that we go. See, Jürgen, if you listen to what Jürgen was saying earlier, you'll have noticed he's absolutely committed to his subjects. Why? He'll not mind me saying this publicly. Because he's committed to the Lord. And those are the areas of life where he's been touched deeply. That comes across. And if we're only mugging up lectures to give to the public and are not committed, we will not come across. It's got to proceed out of a conviction that God is real and the scriptures are true. And we're not just standing up in public to give solutions to problems as a kind of intellectual game. The arguments are very important, but the bottom line is God is using us, or wants to use us, to reach these people. And therefore, we've got to take them seriously, very seriously, and their arguments very seriously, and admit we don't know where we don't know. And you might say to me, but look, you shouldn't talk about biology at all. You're not a biologist. That's a very important objection. You're perfectly right. So what I say is, I'm not a biologist. Why do I talk about it? Because from Darwin to Dawkins, they write for the public. So what I want to do is approach it at that level. And I want to bleat, because what I'm being sold doesn't make sense to me, and I'm bothered about it, so I want to share some of my bothers. I've found no scientists, and I'm often talking to people with endless letters after their name in biology, but they take it because I'm not pretending to be what I'm not. And that is so important. There's nothing that will put the scientific community off by sensing that someone is pretending to be something they're not. That is very important. So I would encourage you, and the way I would encourage you, especially the younger people, is this. Sometimes when you come to a session like this, it's a bit bewildering because of the amount of material that you get thrown at you. And you say, how am I ever going to start? The way you're going to start is to prepare seriously one talk with which you're really comfortable and share it with a few people. That's how I started, one-on-one. If you end up in life only doing public talks and not talking to individuals, you're going to lose the people, because you've got to spend time discussing with people. I spend a large proportion of my time playing Socrates in the academy, going along to very eminent scientists and asking them questions. We're often far too keen to give them our answers, in which they're probably not remotely interested. And we don't show interest in them. But I guarantee you start showing interest in them, and they will show interest in you. And starting and seeing what arguments make sense, and underselling the case, not overselling it. There's an enormous danger of being grab the latest idea and oversell it. It's much better to have a lighter touch, so that people can see, and I make sure people can see, when I'm talking about the most sensitive one of all of these, and you've seen it sensitive, even among Christians, evolution. I make sure the audience can see that my belief in God does not depend on the answer to the question. You see. I have my views on it, and they will see those very clearly. But what I want to do is to create an environment where they see that I'm resting easy in myself with it, because I've got all kinds of other reasons for believing. That's very, very important. And sometimes we can take ourselves far too seriously. We need to learn to laugh at ourselves at the right place and admit that we've made mistakes and blown it. I find it very encouraging to realize that I'm not supporting the universe, but God is. And sometimes the way I speak and think, you'd think the whole of the witness of God to the universe depended on me. Well, that's absurd. God supports us, you know, and I would just want to encourage you to go out from here and work out the stuff you get, but make it your own. Jürgen's point I couldn't emphasize enough. It must be made our own. So we'll all be very different. And there are some areas which some people will be comfortable with, like pain and suffering. When you've been through what Jürgen's been through, you don't have to say very much to gain utter and instant credibility with an audience. But if you're like me, who's terrified of getting toothache, you've got to sort talk a very long time around it, and it comes across as theoretical, because it is, you see. So I don't talk so much about that topic. I will talk if people ask me. But it's theoretical, and we need to get through to where it actually affects our lives. And my own biography has affected the way I think. And I close on this. Have I got one more minute?
You've actually got 12 or 15 more minutes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, to add to what... Okay, right. Well, I don't need 7. Well, I might need 7. We'll see. Just to say that the point that Jürgen started with, and I want to finish on it. Biography. See, my parents were Christians. I'm the exact opposite of Jürgen. That's why we're such good friends, isn't it, Jürgen? We work very well together. There's nothing I like more than being his translator and getting things across. But my parents were Christians. Their parents were Christians, and I think the parents before were Christians. Now, that didn't make me a Christian, but I grew up steeped in Christianity. But my parents, very unusually for Irish people, they allowed me to think. They were not sectarian. You may laugh, but I come across so many students who've not been allowed to think. Christian students from Christian homes, and their faith disappears within 3 weeks of coming to university. So I owe my parents an immense debt. I was allowed to think. And so I'd read many books before I came to university. The first week as a student, somebody said to me, "Do you believe in God?" "Oh, you're Irish. Of course you do. They all do over there. They fight about it." And that just stopped me dead. Wow. I was doing mathematics at a rather good university. And I believed in God because of Irish genetics. That wouldn't do, would it? So what happened? Well, I decided I'd better get to know some atheists. And in those days, I believed that all atheists had beards. It's a very interesting view, isn't it? So... yeah. I looked around the room and I saw a chap exactly like Adam, and I thought he's an atheist. I went up to him and he was, and that proved it, you see. So we became friends. He was actually the brightest person in the year. I didn't know how to talk to him. I discovered his parents were not Christians and their parents weren't, and so on. It's the exact opposite. So we started to talk. I didn't know what to say, so I got a tape recording of someone whom I believe did talk sense, and he used to play bits of it, 5 minutes, and then stop it and talk. After a year, he became a Christian. That was a very big turning point, because I could see that people who were not from my background could cross the bridge from atheism to faith. And that set the whole tone of my life. I spend my life befriending people who do not share my background, who do not share my convictions. And the crucial thing I had to learn was to respect them. One of the things that evangelicals, sadly, are not often good at is respect for people that don't share their views. And alas, they sometimes show it in public. So, that is the story of my life. So it ended up, I have spent a lot of time in Russia particularly, but in the 30 years traveling to Eastern Europe, Poland, German Democratic Republic, which was easier for me because I spoke the language, but then in those days lots of people spoke German. So it was the lingua franca in Hungary here in particular. Talking to people who didn't share my background and being interested in nations that were systematically exposed to Marxism. So that is my biography. And therefore, that is why, to me, the message of creation, that there is a creator, is a passionate message. It's not just an intellectual game for me. It's a passionate message because it's the first step, and only a first step, in getting through to the actual message of the Christian gospel. So Jürgen and I come from completely different backgrounds, but you'll notice the motivation is the same. Sorry to be so long. Yes, you can. I'm finished now.
A woman asks him, why are biologists so fearful, so against, so emotionally opposed to there being a God? Well, before long, he's talking about human rebellion and sin and the cross, you know, because he's explaining to her why there's so much emotional opposition to the existence of a creator. I was struck by that, John. You didn't just use one or two questions. You always seem to find a question. And you know, Charles Sexton, who's kind of an ID icon because he goes to the start of it, he said what you do. He said, I try to get people to ask the God questions.
Oh, absolutely. That's very well put. That's exactly right. Last night was a standard example. And it's sometimes the most unpromising questions that you could use. She said, why are people so, what was it she said, so fearful? And I said, because this raises deeper issues. And it's a very interesting thing. And so we go on. And always in my mind, I'm trying to get across the relevance of the actual gospel message. And of course, you hear a question like that, you just say, yippee, you know, and you go straight in. And I find it very important that having made a rational, logical, hopefully clear argument, that they see that I will be prepared to confess Christianity with equal clarity and not fudge that. Not, oh, well, I actually happen to be a Christian, but if you like, we'll talk about that. Yes, Laszlo. Yes, that's interesting. I too suspected that he was a pantheist. But you have to make the decision, am I going to discuss pantheism, or am I going to use what he says as a bridge? He's looking at the universe, he says there's love in it, therefore there must be love behind it. Well, he's right, you see. And therefore then extrapolate the bit of that argument that becomes the bridge. Instead of saying, well, now, of course, that's a pantheist belief that I detect there, and we now need to examine pantheism. Well, they're hopeless.
Well, how about Paul and Anthony? I mean, he notices that the statues of the unknown God, that's his entry point. You look for those entry points.
Oh, yes, I spend my time in Athens. And look all around, you find the most interesting things standing in the marketplace. Use them. But you notice that, I mean, Athens is important, but you've been told this thousands of times. I put it this way, Paul loved the people enough to have read their poets and was able to quote them. If you don't love people enough to read what they read, you might as well forget about it.